If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
Hi, my name's Dave. I'm the editor of BBC History Magazine, and this is our September podcast. I'm joined today by Deputy Editor Sue.
Hello.
And by our Section Editor, Rob.
Hello.
Coming up this issue...
I've got to admit that occasionally dormice were consumed.
That was Professor Mary Beard, who will be revealing the dormice-eating habits of ancient Pompeians later on.
Elizabeth had a very strong sense of having a hotline to God, and she knew perfectly well what he wanted her to do.
And that was Professor David Lodes, who's taking us back to a hotbed of Reformation fervour in this month's Time Machine.
You could say his main achievement was the execution of the king. Achievement, of course, there is very ambiguous.
And finally, we'll be hearing from Professor John Morrill, who is untangling the reputation of one Oliver Cromwell.
All these subjects are explored in the current issue of BBC History Magazine, and we've got a great subscription offer for you this month. Every new subscriber will get a free copy of an exciting new book on Cromwell called God's Executioner by Michael Osiacru, who's written the cover feature for the magazine. His book explores Cromwell's conquest of Ireland. To claim your free book and to subscribe to the magazine for the reduced price of £8.10 every three issues by direct debit, just call 0844 844-0250 and quote pod 0908 to take up this offer. Or go to www.subscribeonline.co.uk/history magazine and again quote pod 0908.
We'll repeat that subscription number at the end. And now, onto the dormice. Pompeii, famous for Romans frozen in time after the eruption of Vesuvius in AD 79, is the subject of Professor Mary Beard's latest book, and she has written an A to Z of Pompeii for the magazine. So let's hear from her now. Mary, you've got your book on Pompeii coming out. Could you very quickly run over the history of the place for anyone who's not familiar with it?
Yeah, well, in some ways, Pompeii is the most famous Roman town that there is. But that conceals a rather strange fact, honestly, which is that Pompeii was actually only a Roman town for about 150, 160 years of its existence. It actually started out back in the 6th century BC as a little non-Roman town in South Italy, with bits of Greek influence, bits of Etruscan influence, bits of so-called Oscan influence from the people who lived around there. And it had nothing very much to do with Rome to start with. What happened to Pompeii, like to all towns in Roman Italy, gradually, is the vast might of Rome eventually comes and gobbles it up. And by 80 BC, it has become, after a rather bloody war, in fact, it's become an absolutely standard Roman town. It has a colony of Roman veteran soldiers put in it. And that's the period of Pompeii that we know best. But it's got a long history. It finishes in 79, but it goes back much longer than anybody ever realises.
And it finishes in 79, of course, because of the eruption of Vesuvius.
It finishes in 79, a very dramatic way with the eruption of Vesuvius. But the history goes back to well back into the 6th century BC, hundreds of years. And we know much less about the early history of Pompeii than we do about the last Roman town, partly because archaeologists, for obvious reasons, have been... reluctant to destroy the Roman remains to find out what happened first. But we have got more information than we used to have about what the beginning of Pompeii was like.
Now, you mentioned about the new research and the new findings that have come out of Pompeii. Can you highlight one or two things which are really exciting that have come out of Pompeii recently?
Well, I don't know if this is really exciting, but one of the things that most intrigued me was the study of what we might call the one-way street system, that When you go to Pompeii, and anybody visits Pompeii, the one thing that everybody remembers is the ruts in the street. You know, that you, it's terribly evocative in some way. You see these cart ruts, and you think, God, you know, this is really where an ancient cart once went. And you see everybody being fascinated by these. It's only recently that some rather clever archaeologists, starting with a group from Japan, actually, decided to look more carefully at these ruts and at the scraping marks in the street, and to try and work out something from the ruts about the whole traffic plan of the city. Because there's one obvious problem that anybody who walks around Pompeii discovers, which is that most of the streets, not all of them, most of them are very narrow. So how on earth did two carts pass? Now, by carefully looking at some of these ruts and looking at the scraping of the cart marks as they went round the corners, there's been the beginning of an understanding of actually which way carts did go down the street. And now some people, perhaps over-optimistically, I think, have pretty well identified what they say is the one-way street system of the town. But there are other things. Come on, I'll tell you a few other things, which are, in a sense, actually new discoveries. And one of the most interesting houses, which is not yet open to the public, though it hopes as it will be in due course, is a house that was excavated 15 years ago. And that, in this house, quite a large house, rather glamorous house with nice gardens, etc. One of the things that was discovered in that was a room, a big, perhaps dining room, where the painters had been redecorating it. The painters had been redecorating it just at the moment that the eruption came. And it looks as if they just scarpered. They just, there must be one rumble too many. And they got, right, we're off. And they left behind them just what they'd been working with, their ladders and their planks and their scaffolding and their paintbrushes and their buckets of plaster. And you can see from all this, and from the unfinished state of the room, you can start to see how a team of Pompeian interior decorators actually worked on those paintings that are now so impressive when you visit the site and you see them in their finished form. And you can see how they did drawings on the plaster underneath before they quickly put on the finished paint, because they're working in fresco technique, which is on wet plaster. So they have, in the end, they do everything terribly quickly. And you can see the line drawings and their undercoating. It's absolutely fascinating for saying, right, how were these paintings that are, you know, they're gorgeous paintings, some of the Pompeian things, how were they actually produced? It looks as if this one was done with a team of, you know, perhaps three or four guys working very quickly, and sadly didn't finish in this case.
So if anyone listening has been tempted to pay a visit to Pompeii, what would you suggest that they really shouldn't miss?
Kind of a bit of a cop-out, but I think the first thing I'd say is forget going to a monument at all. The first thing. The thing that's really impressive about Pompeii, even now, and even when bits of it are closed off, is you walk down the street, you cross the stepping stones from one pavement to another, you dodge the cart ruts where you might twist your ankle, and you can feel yourself back in 79 AD. So what I would say to someone to do first is get a sense, you know, do the romantic bit, you know, walk along, follow the stream of other visitors, because there's millions of visitors a year, but you know, as soon as you see a street with nobody in it, dive down it and just enjoy it. I think that's the most impressive thing about the city, is simply the ambiance. You know, you do feel as if you're back in the ancient world, and you can find streets, even in July and August, you can still find streets where you're the only person. Then I'd visit the brothel. I mean, it's cheesy and all the rest, but the Pompeian brothel has been recently restored and done up. It's, I'm afraid, a tourist hotspot, but it's sort of worth it. You know, you can go into this building, which was the sex industry of ancient Pompeii. You can see the erotic paintings kind of advertising the wares above the doors of the little cubicles. You can see the little cubicles where the girls, we think it was girls, operated. And you can see the loo in the back. And you are walking through a Pompeii and Brussels. And I think that's, you know, that brings all kinds of different and ambivalent reflections, I think. But it is very impressive, even if you are there with hundreds of other people, which I'm afraid you will be.
In the magazine this month, you've written an A to Z of Pompeii. And I'd just like to pick up on a couple of points you've made there. Your D is diet and, in brackets, dormice. So did the Romans actually really eat dormice?
Well, the beard view is that not half as often as we imagine. But working on Pompeii has meant that I've got to admit that occasionally dormice were consumed. That's because there's a handful of small objects, very odd objects, which are kind of pots with internal runways in them, embedded into the door, into the wall of the pot. So you've got like a round jar with little sort of runs running up the inside. It's very difficult to describe. What is absolutely amazing about these is that if you looked at them, you wouldn't have the foggiest clue what they were for. You can then go to ancient writing about different sorts of animals and how they're kept, and they match up absolutely to something called a glirarium, which is a dormouse cage where dormice could be kept conveniently in the home to fatten them up before you decided to put them on the table. So unless there's something that I haven't thought about, which would be another explanation for what these funny jars are, I have to admit, slightly reluctantly, that the Pompeians did occasionally nibble a tasty dormouse.
Right. It does sound like a curious bit of tableware.
It is a curious bit of tableware, indeed.
And your L in our A to Z is L for lavatories. So go on, tell us what we know about Pompeian toilet habits.
Well, don't get too excited about the fantastic plumbing of the ancient world when it comes to Pompeii. They do have running water, but the ancients are much more keen on having running water to run their fountains in their gardens than to flush their loos with. Right. So mostly what you've got, most houses have got lavatories, but they're not flush jobs, though some of them are. Mostly they are holes running into a cesspit, flush no doubt with a bucket of water thrown down them, and they are mostly in the kitchen. This is because I imagine that they served as lavatory plus waste disposal unit for the peelings, and everything was flushed down into the cesspit underneath. And it's a bit, I think it takes you back a bit to think, you know, one thing that we know, every blasted regulation for buildings tell us we have to have, you know, X number of doors between a lavatory and a food preparation order area. Go back to Pompeii and you find the loos in the kitchen. Wow. But they do at least give you some opportunity, as I said, they give you some opportunity of analysing the residue and finding out just what came out of Pompeian intestines. And where you can excavate the cesspits underneath, which is another nice innovation of modern archaeology, you can get quite a good idea of what was going through the bowels of a Pompeian.
Thanks, Mary. And you can, of course, read the full A to Z in the current issue of the magazine. Mary Beard's Pompeii is on sale now, but let's go to Rob to hear his rundown of the three things that history lovers should do this month.
OK, well, to start off with, a great event that happens every September is Heritage Open Days. That takes place this year from the 11th to the 14th of September, and what usually happens is that thousands of properties all over England open their doors to the public for free. Some of these places aren't normally accessible, others normally charge for entry, and there's also special events going on. Now, although this is only taking place in England, there are similar programmes elsewhere in the UK as part of European Heritage Days.
OK, good. Number two?
Well, number two, our exhibition of the month this month is about the First World War. As many listeners may know, it's the 90th anniversary of the end of the First World War coming up in November. There's going to be a lot of things taking place to mark that, but the Imperial War Museum is starting early with an exhibition called In Memoriam. This tells the story of the war through the personal experiences of a variety of people who were actually involved in the conflict. The exhibition opens on the 30th of September, and it's a very important one for the museum because the museum itself was founded due to the war in 1917. And we're actually also doing a First World War special issue in November, which is something else to look out for.
Yes, it is. And indeed, I've just interviewed Michael Palin for that because he's presenting a Time Watch programme all about the last day of the First World War. That will be in our November podcast. But for the third thing, what to do?
If the weather continues as it has done recently, you might well be looking for something good to watch on the box. And what our pick for this month is a programme called Arena, The Hunt for Moby Dick, which at the moment is looking like it's going on the 20th of September, but it's always worth checking your listing guides. Now, this programme examines the 19th century whaling industry, which inspired Melville's classic novel, and it has a lot of contemporary relevance as well with all the modern debates about whaling. And as always, you can read more about all of these things in the magazine.
Thank you, Rob. Three good choices for things for history enthusiasts to do this month. Now, Rob has also been talking to Professor David Lodes about his preferred destination for a trip in the BBC History magazine Time Machine. So let's hear what year he would most like to visit if he could be transported back in time.
Why have you chosen 1558?
Well, it's the turning point of the English Reformation, really. It's the year of Mary's death and Elizabeth's accession. Mary dies on the 17th of November, 1558. Elizabeth succeeds. That is the, as it turns out, the end of the attempt to restore and maintain the Catholic religion in England.
Would people at the time have realised that?
Yes, I think so, pretty quickly after the event, because there's been this very high-profile persecution has been going on, which had maintained right up to Mary's death. And as soon as Mary dies, the persecution stops. Everybody who knew anything about the situation was quite well aware that Elizabeth had conformed to the Catholic faith very reluctantly under pressure, and that she was now going to do something different. It wasn't quite known what she would do, but it would certainly be different from what had been there before.
When you're back in 1558, who would you like to speak to?
Oh, Elizabeth, I think, or William Cecil, possibly. Get more out of William Cecil, I think, probably.
What would you ask him?
What he thought the immediate future held and what his relationship with Elizabeth was really like.
What do you think he'd say?
Well, he would be very discreet, and he would say she is a noble and a gracious dame, and basically I respect her intellect, and I will do what she bids me to do, which would be in a coded way of saying she will take my advice if she knows what's good for her.
Right, and did she take his advice in the end?
On most issues, yes. Not always. He was opposed to the intervention in France in 1562. She didn't take his advice on that. But I think she certainly took his advice over the religious settlement, which was just coming up, of course, as settled in the early part of 1559. I mean, they saw very closely eye to eye. They'd both been Nicodemites under Mary. They'd both conformed rather reluctantly, or very reluctantly indeed. But they had conformed, and they were not, therefore, of the extreme godly party which was looking to take over power in 1558.
They played quite an important role at this point in steering Britain's religious future.
Oh, Cecil is very important, really, well, throughout his political life from then on until his death in 1598, but he's particularly important at the beginning because there is so much to be decided. I mean, the other thing where he was very clearly extremely influential was over the intervention in Scotland in 1560, which was very largely his doing. He's pushing the Queen to make decisions because she's hesitating all the time, saying, I don't want to get involved. And he's saying, you must get involved. This is your opportunity to settle the situation in Scotland in England's favour. And so it turned out, of course, he was quite right about that.
Do you think in 1558 Elizabeth was already planning the restoration of Protestantism?
Oh yes, I think so, undoubtedly. I think this was her great opportunity. Elizabeth had a very strong sense of having a hot line to God, and she knew perfectly well what he wanted her to do, and what he wanted her to do was to restore the true godly religion, which was Protestantism.
Did she make that explicit at the time?
Well, Elizabeth never made anything very explicit. I mean, her gestures were pretty explicit. First thing she does is to say, well, just carry on as usual, but stop the persecution. That isn't a recorded order, but it happened nonetheless. But then, of course, during a service in the Chapel Royal at the very beginning of 1559, when Owen Oglethorpe was celebrating Mass, which was still being celebrated at that point, she walks out before the elevation of their host, which was a very, very clear indication that she didn't approve of the Mass. And then the Mass, which is celebrated at her coronation, she takes communion secretly in both kinds behind a screen. And there again, that was not strictly lawful at the time, but it's fairly clear that that was what she intended to do.
Are there any historical debates you'd like to settle if you were in 1558?
Well, yes, I think the first interesting question that I would want answered is who drafted those statutes in 1559 and where the ideas, we know who drafted them, but where the ideas actually came from, to what extent Cecil was influencing them, whether the ideas came mainly from the Queen herself. As I say, we know who drafted the statutes, but what we don't know is the discussions that went on behind them. So that is one. The other question I would like to ask is, the question of the ending of the war between France and Spain. We know about the English commissioners who were sent out to take part in the negotiations at Cateau-Cambrésis, but how serious was Elizabeth really in trying to retain Calais? She swore she'd cut the heads off her commissioners if they came back and they surrendered Calais, but of course they did and she accepted it.
So whether it was just bravado?
Well, I think it was just, it was just Elizabeth throwing a tantrum, which she was very well qualified to do. I mean, she was an excellent actress, was Elizabeth, and you can never really tell in all the recorded incidents whether she's playing up or being genuinely annoyed.
Was the arrival of Elizabeth the throne one of the most sort of defining moments of British history?
Yes, I think it was, because although if Henry VIII hadn't established the royal supremacy, there wouldn't have been any precedent for what happened in 1559. At the same time, if Mary had had a child who'd succeeded and the Catholic Church had gone on, the whole subsequent history of England would have been completely different.
Do you think the image we have of Elizabeth these days, especially with all those films and TV programmes, how accurate isn't it the image the public have of her?
Well, I think one can forget the films and TV programmes. I mean, they're out to entertain and not to inform very largely. I think if you look at the recent biographies of Elizabeth McCaffrey's, mine, David Starkey's and so on, you'll find a pretty accurate representation of what we now think the Queen was like, which is all one can say, really. You can't get any closer than what the evidence allows.
Okay, so I'm now going to drag us kicking and screaming back from 1558 up to the present day 2008 to explore what new history books are on sale with the deputy editor Sue Wingrove. So Sue, tell us, what book should we be looking out for this month?
Okay, we looked at 12 books in the September issue and this is my pick of three of them. First up is A Daughter's Love, written by John Guy. This is a book on Thomas More's daughter, who played an important role in the martyrs' troubled last months. When the Lord Chancellor was languishing in the Tower of London, under suspicion of treason for refusing to acknowledge the legitimacy of Henry's marriage to Anne Boleyn, or to accept Henry's claim to be head of the English Church, Margaret did more than anyone else to buoy up More's flagging spirits.
Why would I read it?
Well, it's good because Guy rescues Margaret from relative obscurity and shows her to be a woman of mighty intellect and deep compassion, who, furthermore, secured her father's posthumous reputation by preserving all the letters that she exchanged with him. Guy supplied a wealth of intimate, fascinating details, one of the most compelling stories in Tudor history. And in this book, he has brought the fruit of many years' research on Thomas More to a wider reading public.
John Guy has a happy knack of being able to bring history alive. What about your second choice?
Yes, second choice is very different. Dunkirk, The Men They Left Behind by Sean Longdon. This is a book on Dunkirk, the heroic evacuation of the British Army from France that snatched salvation from defeat in 1940. But there is a twist, because although some 300,000 British and French troops escaped the Nazis to fight another day, when the last boat left the Dunkirk quayside in the darkness, there were some 68,000 British soldiers left behind. And here Sean tells their harrowing story.
And how would you persuade me to pick up this particular title?
Well, it's good because he has talked with dozens of survivors and writes with great passion about their fate. He saves for posterity the experiences of men whose suffering has too readily been forgotten. This book also debunks the rather rosy picture of POW life that emerged in the post-war years.
Okay, your final choice.
Okay, Europe Between the Oceans, 9000 BC to AD 1000 by Barry Cunliffe. This is a book on 10,000 years of European history, from the Mesolithic to the point when the nation-states, which now constitute Europe, were starting to take shape. It tells how Europe rose from being on the far periphery of the development of agricultural and urbanisation to the eve of Western Europe's imperial ambitions to dominate the rest of the world.
OK, well, I love my archaeology, so this won't take much, but Sue, sell it to me.
Well, OK, it's good because it's not only by the former professor of European archaeology at the University of Oxford, so he really knows his stuff, but it's also a good read and it's got stunning photos of sites and objects and is also reasonably priced.
Excellent. Well, there we are. That's free books to keep an eye out for this month. Now, Sue has been in conversation with another of our feature writers this month, who is none other than Professor John Morrill. John has contributed to our special issue, which commemorates the 350th anniversary of the death of Oliver Cromwell. And he's been explaining how the stock of Cromwell's reputation has risen and fallen over the last 3.5 centuries.
Today I'd like to welcome John Morrill, Professor of British and Irish History at the University of Cambridge and author of an authoritative biography on Oliver Cromwell. So John, Cromwell is obviously a hugely important figure in British history, but 350 years after his death in 1658, he remains also a controversial figure, doesn't he?
He does indeed, yeah. It's partly that his actions, both are easily to be admired, his commitment to religious freedom and so on, but also to be worried about, like the extreme violence he used in the conquest of Ireland and Scotland. And so, you know, it's obviously how one, you know, weighs it against one another, and also how one weighs both sincerity and the ferocity of his religious faith. These are complicated things at all periods.
Indeed. And what would we call his main achievements?
Well, you could say his main achievement was the execution of the king. Achievement, of course, there is very ambiguous. But, I mean, the recognition that this king who'd lost the civil war was plunging the country into anarchy because of his refusal to accept, you know, the logic of his defeat. To have the sort of nerve to put a king on trial and execute him again is controversial, but certainly admirable in terms of the way it was done. And I suppose, again, very controversially, the most complete ever, you know, English conquest of both Ireland and Scotland. I mean, kings have been trying to do it for centuries and had failed, and he managed it. On a much more positive side, he was instrumental in achieving a much greater degree of religious freedom than had ever existed before, or was to exist again, really, until the very end of the 19th century. So he not only gave people freedom to worship, but he said, you know, whether or not you're part of the state church, you have equal right to hold office, to go to university, to become join the professions. And these sorts equal rights, as well as liberties for people of a variety of religious views, are way ahead of his time.
Indeed. So these are things that we value today. And if I was to ask for what he might be reviled, I guess you'd go back to the beginning of your last answer about killing the king and so forth.
Well, of course, you know, from the monarchy's point of view, it did come back. And did come back chastened and a bit wiser. The great predecessor, Christopher Hill, you know, once said that the kings never forgot again that they had a joint in their neck. You know, that in a sense he was arguing that those who rule are accountable to those who are their subjects or citizens. And that sense that in the end those who exercise power are accountable, although he did it in a dramatic way, is a lesson that was learnt. So even that could be seen as some kind of positive. On the other hand, it's very difficult to see his what he did in Ireland as anything other than leaving a very, very long legacy, not simply in the massacres that took place, albeit massacres which were avenging massacres by Catholics or Protestants, a cycle of violence into which he entered, but nonetheless entered very brutally, but the massive expropriation of land, about 40% of the landmass of Ireland was confiscated from Catholics born in Ireland and given to Protestants born in Britain. So this is a very, very troubled legacy, which, you know, has hopefully in the last few years begun to be resolved, but has caused endless misery for many, many people over the last 150 years.
Yes, and readers can find out more about the massacre of soldiers and civilians at Drogheda in 1649 in our current issue, where we have a feature by Michael Osiacru. So let's go back a moment to the execution of Charles I. Of course, he was not only the king, but he believed that he ruled by divine right. So obviously, there was a whole religious aspect to this.
Well, the whole point, I think, is that there'd been trial by battle between two views of Britain's destiny, and both sides appealed to God as the judge, and God had decisively come down the parliamentarian side. So for the king to refuse to accept defeat, for him to plot and conspire to overturn that victory and to begin a second civil war, wasn't only, as it were, politically frustrating, it was also, in a sense, an attempt to overturn the judgment of gods. It was a kind of blasphemy or sacrilege. And Cromwell became convinced that that God was so impatient with a king who had shed the innocent blood of his own subjects that he deserved to die. And so there was a very strong religious motive. The one thing I would want to make clear is that Cromwell wished to abolish Charles I. He didn't wish to abolish monarchy. And
right.
We should never see the regicide as being inevitably leading to a republic. From Cromwell's point of view, various forms of government were equally good so long as they were answerable to God's plan to produce liberty, both civil and religious liberty. And he was always looking for the option of restoring some form of monarchy, either in a more chastened House of Stuart or possibly in a House of Cromwell.
Right. So, in a sense, both sides felt that they had God on their side point.
Yeah, absolutely. Yes. Both sides demonised the other. In a literal sense, both sides believed that the other was destroying order and creating anarchy and creating religious chaos. In Parliament, thought the king was bringing back the old tyrannical forms of Catholicism by the back door. The king thought that the Puritans were unleashing forces of religious fanaticism which were linked to anarchy.
Yeah. So with Cromwell's own contemporaries, the people on his side, what did they think of him? Because they must have seen the having to put the king to death as the very last resort.
Yeah. Cromwell, although he came from quite a wealthy family, was part of a junior branch of it, so he himself was possibly the poorest man in the House of Commons in 1640, so his social superiors thought he was a bit of an upstart, and his absolute determination to win an outright victory, to impose a settlement on the king, really upset a lot of more cautious people on the parliamentarian side, who always looked for a negotiated settlement and didn't want to humiliate the king. They thought humiliating the king would only cause more trouble than it was worth in the long run. And so Cromwell was very suspected by a lot of both social and more religious conservatives than himself. On the other hand, he had the fanatical support of all who served with him. I mean, he had this extraordinary ability to lead in battle and to make those who served on him believe in that both in the cause they were fighting for and in his, his personal favour with God. And he never really lost the support of the vast majority of people who served under him. And in Parliament, well, he was simply someone who was so ruthless in saying all this suffering, all this death and desolation which the war has caused, we cannot then make a settlement that is dishonourable to those who have suffered. So he is a very hard line. A very hard-line negotiator for a settlement which the king finds he won't accept, even though he is in prison and a defeated man. He simply thinks in the end they will reach a compromise with him, and of course he misjudges.
Yes, indeed. And so, John, the feature you've written for us in the magazine this month takes a look at just how Cromwell's reputation has ebbed and flowed in the past three centuries. And readers can find out more about that by taking a look at the magazine. So back to the present, what do historians today think about Cromwell?
On the whole, he's had a very good press in the last 50 years or so. He went through a bad patch in the 1930s when his rise to absolute power made him look a bit too like the great totalitarians, and a couple of very influential biographies were written likening him to Hitler. This phase passed pretty quickly, and since World War II there have been 20 or 30 biographies which are very favourable. A very influential one by Christopher Hill saw him as someone who both made and then betrayed a revolution, someone who was the great sort of hero of popular liberty in the 1640s, who failed to live up to his own high promises of liberty in the 1650s. But the rest of the biographies have more or less taken him at his word. He is a very powerful, he wrote over 400 letters that we still have, and he made more than 30 speeches, which were written down pretty much as he gave them in shorthands that were being developed at the time, and were efficient shorthands. So we do have a pretty good sense of his words, and he gives a very passionate account of himself as someone who is freeing people from tyranny, the tyranny of kings, the tyranny of bishops, and the notion of a state church which everybody had to belong. Someone who believed in freedom, believed in responsibility. So he believed the rich had all kinds of duties to the poor which the state had to enforce, and he believed in governors who were accountable to their people. So, and on the whole, historians think that this is a sincere program, and they don't believe the testimony of a lot of his contemporaries who thought he was a canting hypocrite, always striving for personal power and using a rhetoric of liberty in order to achieve it. When I go around talking to sixth formers, I find them much more sceptical about that. They're hardened to not believing politicians' words.
Yes.
but the very experienced historians who've actually been through the records very carefully have got pretty close to a consensus of rather admiring him, but being slightly kind of apprehensive about the ferocity of his religious belief. And with the rise of religious fundamentalism, religious fundamentalisms in the last few years,
yes,
just a note of caution is beginning to creep in. And I rather expect that that religious fanaticism of his kind might be seen much less favourably in the next few years, and we may begin to get some more hostile biographies.
John Morrill, thank you very much. Okay, and that was John Morrill talking about Cromwell's reputation. Also in the current issue is Michal Osiacru looking at the massacre of Drogheda. Now, don't forget, you can get a copy of Michal Osiacru's book, God's Executioner, free when you subscribe to BBC History Magazine this month. Just call 0844 844 0250 and quote pod 0908 to take up the offer. Hurry, because this is a limited offer and closes at the end of September. Or you can go to www.subscribeonline.co.uk/history magazine and again quote pod 0908.
Okay, that is it for this month. If you want more history, I would encourage you to go and buy the magazine, or if not, why not go and visit our website, www.bbchistorymagazine.com, to read our brand new blogs, sign up for our weekly History on TV e-newsletter, or to chat on the forum. And do look out for next month's podcast, when Professor Richard Evans will be giving us a 5-minute lecture on how far the German people supported Hitler's Third Reich.
And I'll be talking to Hannah Gregg about her experiences as historical advisor to the new drama The Duchess, starring Keira Knightley.
Do join us next month. It'll be brilliant.
A collision between a Chinese jet and an American spy plane.
He came and rammed into our left wing.
With relations increasingly strained, what are the chances of things spinning out of control?
The Western world was asleep.
I'm Gordon Carrera. I'll be exploring the friction in this most important of relationships and asking, has the West taken its eye off the ball?
You cannot ignore China.
From BBC Radio 4, this is Shadow War, China and the West. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.